Today is Monday, November 23rd, and you are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, citizens of the Horn of Africa call for peace in Ethiopia.
Nobody can win the war unless you avoid it.
Also ahead, a British COVID-19 vaccine candidate shows promise.
It's a vaccine that has high effectiveness in one of the dosage regimes that have been tried out.
Plus, we hear from Iraqis accused of and acquitted of supporting the Islamic State. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Israel. Israeli media is reporting that Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visited Saudi Arabia Saturday, the first confirmed visit by an Israeli leader to the Arab Kingdom. Netanyahu reportedly met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. For more on what is known about the meeting and what the implications might be for the Middle East, I reached out to journalist Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Linda, thank you so much for joining us. First of all, what do we know so far about this meeting?
The report started in the Israeli media, and it started because somebody on Twitter posted that this private plane that belongs to this businessman had made a trip from Tel Aviv to Neom, which is on the Red Sea coast in Saudi Arabia, and which was where Mike Pompeo was also meeting the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman at the same time. And then we had, sort of indirect reports in the Israeli press, which have now been confirmed by an Israeli cabinet minister. And we've also had reports from Saudi Arabia. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that two Saudi officials have also confirmed the meeting. So it was Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, Mike Pompeo, the secretary of state, who was wrapping up a seven-nation trip, and the head of the Israeli Mossad, Yossi Cohen. And according to the reports, they talked about Iran and they talked about the incoming Biden administration. There was no announcement of that Saudi Arabia would open diplomatic relations with Israel, which is, of course, something that Israel has been hoping for a long time. And it follows by a few months the decision by the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain to normalize relations with Israel.
And so can you explain what's the significance of this meeting, and also why would this be done, at least initially, in secret?
Well, I think it was done in secret because there was always this kind of idea. And in fact, the foreign minister of Saudi Arabia said it just this weekend that there cannot be normalization between Israel and Saudi Arabia without an agreement on the Palestinian issue. And what happened with the UAE and Bahrain is that they basically, threw the Palestinians under the bus and said, we want to have normalization with Israel, and we basically partly to get the F-35s, which the U.S. then agreed to sell them as part of this whole deal. Saudi Arabia is kind of, the big fish in all this. It's a huge country in the Gulf. It has tremendous oil wealth. It has a lot of regional Middle East importance. And an agreement by Saudi Arabia to normalize ties with Israel would be a big achievement both for Israel and for President Trump. And so it seems that he mentioned a couple months ago that there will be other nations joining this deal with Israel. And of course, the background reason for all of this is Iran, that there is concern about Iran becoming a nuclear power, Iran's growing strength. And it's seen as kind of a moderate access of Israel, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain against Iran, Hezbollah, which is its proxy militia in South Lebanon, and Syria, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. So I think that it would mean a kind of changing the whole Middle East. It would give Israel more legitimacy. It would be a big sort of farewell move by President Trump. However, I think we're not quite there yet. This is the first step. But I don't think that we're going to see full normalization, at least not yet.
And has there been any reaction to this meeting from the Palestinian side?
Yes, a spokesman for Hamas, which runs Gaza, you know, Hamas, the Islamist Hamas movement, sharply criticized this meeting and criticized Saudi Arabia for doing this. Palestinians kind of feel like the Arab world has sort of abandoned them. And there's a lot of frustration among Palestinians, which this is only the latest thing. I mean, they feel that President Trump has been completely pro-Israel, moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, recognizing the Golan Heights as part of Israel, legalizing Jewish settlements in the West Bank. And this is just what they see as kind of the latest stab in the back to the Palestinians.
One last question. You mentioned the F-35s, which are those U.S.-built fighter jets for the UAE. Was there any indication of any weapons deals or trade at the Saudi meeting?
No, there were no details really have come out yet, and the meeting only lasted a couple of hours. So we don't know of any weapons deals that might have come out, although, I mean, it's logical to think that if the UAE got F-35s for a normalization with Israel, that the Saudis would certainly get something as well, but we don't have any details at this point.
That's journalist Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Thank you so much for joining us, Linda.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
The University of Oxford and AstraZeneca say their COVID-19 vaccine candidate appears highly effective, preventing 70% of people from developing the coronavirus. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has more.
The University of Oxford and AstraZeneca say late-stage trials of their COVID-19 vaccine were highly effective in preventing disease, preventing 70% of people from developing the coronavirus. Oxford and AstraZeneca say the trials so far indicate if people are given a half dose followed by a full dose, rather than two full doses, protection then rises to about 90%. At the WHO, Special Envoy David Nabarro welcomed the news.
It's a vaccine that can be stored at fridge temperature for longer periods. It's a vaccine that has high effectiveness in one of the dosage regimes that have been tried out.
The vaccine news follows last week's announcement from Pfizer and Moderna, saying results show their COVID-19 vaccines were almost 95% effective. Charles de Ledesma, London.
Chinese authorities are testing millions of people, imposing lockdowns and shutting down schools after locally transmitted coronavirus cases were discovered in three cities across the country last week. With temperatures dropping, authorities are enacting widespread measures in the cities of Tianjin, Shanghai, and Manzhouli. Shanghai's Pudong International Airport is testing more than 17,000 people after two new cases of the virus were found, and plans to call for the testing of others in surrounding communities. In the northern port of Tianjin, health workers have collected more than 2.2 million samples for testing, while in Manzhouli, in the northern Inner Mongolia region, local health authorities are testing all city residents after two cases were reported on Saturday. The world's largest outbreak is in the U.S., which averaged more than 170,000 new cases and over 1,500 deaths each day over the last week. As the outbreak worsens, a spokesman for President-elect Joe Biden says the Trump administration should start sharing COVID-19 vaccine information with them. AP's Shelley Adler reports.
The distribution of COVID-19 vaccines will start under President Trump, but will continue after Inauguration Day. And that's why on ABC's This Week, Ron Klain, the chief of staff for President-elect Joe Biden, says they need information.
Our transition isn't getting access to agency officials to help develop our plans, and there's a lot of focus on that vaccine rollout plan that's going to be critical in the early days of a Biden presidency.
University of Virginia presidential historian Barbara Perry agrees, adding the vaccine could be part of the Trump legacy.
He should be given some credit for that, but I would say the debit side of that ledger will obliterate his credit because he won't give out the information to the incoming president.
I'm Shelley Adler.
This is VOA. A federal district court in Washington on Friday granted a preliminary injunction prohibiting officials from the Voice of America's parent agency from interfering with the agency's journalism. The ruling relates to a complaint filed by one VOA official and five officials from its parent agency called the U.S. Agency for Global Media, or USAGM. They argued that actions taken by USAGM and its head, Michael Peck, were unlawful and violated a firewall set up to prevent outside interference in VOA's journalism. The ruling marked a setback for PAC, a former conservative documentary producer appointed by President Trump to head USAGM. Since PAC was confirmed by the Senate in late June, the top leaders at VOA and other networks resigned or were removed. Hiring and spending were frozen, and PAC stopped approving visa renewals for the agency's foreign journalists. Moreover, PAC's political appointees conducted internal investigations of reporters and editors suspected of producing news stories unfavorable to Trump and the administration, having a chilling effect on the work of editors and reporters, according to the complaint. Under the order, USAGM officials, including PAC, are prohibited from, quote, making or interfering with personnel decisions, end quote, related to individual editorial staff at VOA and its sister networks, directly communicating with editors and journalists, with the exception of the heads of those networks or unless they have a director's consent, and conducting investigations into content, journalists, and alleged breaches of ethics at the networks. USAGM did not respond to VOA's email requesting comment. You are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. As the war in Ethiopia escalates, citizens of the Horn of Africa are calling for peace. Eritrean journalist Abraham Tesfalul Zere helped organize a petition demanding peace, which has attracted over 1,000 signatures so far, including support from dozens of prominent intellectuals from Ethiopia and neighboring countries. For more, I reached out to Zere at his home in the U.S. state of Ohio. Abraham, thank you so much for joining us. First of all, can you explain what is the message of this petition?
The message of this petition is people from 44 notable writers, journalists, scholars and analysts, members of civil society from Sudan, Eritrea, Kenya, Ethiopia, Somalia, Somaliland, and Sudan. We are basically calling the involved parties, mainly TPLF and the central government led by Abiy, to de-escalate the war and seek peaceful solution and negotiation. Again, we are also calling other notable African personalities to quickly intervene and possibly mediate the conflict peacefully. Again, we are also calling other parties like UN, IGAD, African Union, to involve and de-escalate the situation and seek some kind of peaceful solution.
And why did you and your colleagues feel the need to put this petition together?
You know, it's historical failure if people of the countries involved or neighboring countries do not alert or condemn such pointless civil war that would affect the lives of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of the people. So it's, among others, a call to condemn the war and, second, warn the involved parties to reconsider their stand and de-escalate the conflict. And as said, to call notable African individuals and leaders and influential personalities to intervene as quickly as possible and mediate the conflict before it goes out of way. And, you know, unfortunately, now it's beyond what we initially were calling for.
You know, like you've said, the war has already gone beyond where it was when you first put together this petition. But what has the response been to the petition?
You know, we don't have the actual power to avert the war, but just alert the concerned citizens of the countries. Although it's difficult to measure the outcome of such initiative, the fact that it got some media traction and been widely circulating among circles who might have influence on the war is something positive. The conflict has escalated quicker than many feared, but again, we are reaffirming and pressing the only solution is peaceful negotiation.
You yourself are from Eritrea, and you mentioned that there has been support from people who come from Ethiopia's neighboring countries. But what about people within Ethiopia? What's the support been like there? And in particular, has there been support for your petition from the different ethnic groups within Ethiopia, from Oromo, from Amhara, from people from Tigray?
In fact, you're right. We have been trying to reach, like, from all the major parts. For example, there were people from Oromo ethnic group, from Amhara ethnic group, and from Tigray ethnic group, or Tigrinya ethnic group from Tigray. So we have got, like, all of them on board.
One thing that I've noticed, especially on social media, is that there is a lot of pro-war rhetoric, not only from politicians or generals, but also from Ethiopians at the grassroots. What would your message be to ordinary Ethiopians, whatever their politics might be, whatever their ethnicity? What would your message be to those who are supporting war as a way to solve this dispute?
You know, peace is very important for every human being in general. But the stakes are very high in case like Ethiopia, with over 100 million population. It's a country that has been ravaged with conflicts. And the Horn of Africa is one of the most impoverished parts of the world. And by all its nature, civil wars cannot be confined in one country. We can see the outcome of this already. Tigrans were fleeing to neighboring countries, Sudan. And it's very clear one way or another, countries like Eritrea, Sudan are involved already now. And it's inevitable that other countries like Egypt, or China, superpowers, or Turkey, Qatar would soon involve and then protract the war. And this kind of civil war would never end. Like, so it's only begins, but never ends. So I would say to citizens of the countries, you know, as much as possible, try to escalate or avoid the rhetoric of war, because nobody can win the war unless you avoid it.
That's Eritrean journalist Abraham Tesfalu Zere speaking to me from the U.S. state of Ohio. Thank you so much, Abraham.
Thank you, Justin. All right. Have a nice day.
Three prominent pro-democracy activists were taken into custody Monday in Hong Kong after pleading guilty to charges related to a protest outside a police headquarters last June. Joshua Wong and fellow members of the now disbanded Democisto political party, Yvonne Lam and Agnes Chow, all in their 20s, took the guilty plea at the advice of their lawyers. Reuters' Brian Wood reports.
Hong Kong activist Joshua Wong was taken into custody on Monday after pleading guilty to charges of illegal assembly last year, which could land him in jail for up to 3 years if he's convicted at a later date. While Wong was taken away by the courtroom staff, he shouted, "Everyone hang in there." The assembly in question took place near the city's police headquarters in June last year. Fellow longtime activists Ivan Lam and Agnes Chow were remanded in custody at the same trial after they, too, pleaded guilty for similar charges. Wong spoke out over his situation before entering the court Monday.
"Perhaps the authorities wish me to stay in prison, but I'm persuaded neither prison bars, nor election bans, nor any other arbitrary power will stop us from activism."
Wong's and other activists' repeated arrests have drawn criticism from Western governments, who say China is not fulfilling its obligation to allow Hong Kong a high degree of autonomy after its handover in 1997. China denies the accusation and says Hong Kong is its internal affair. Wong was not a leading figure in last year's protests, but his activist career since the 2014 Umbrella Movement has drawn Beijing's anger. Hours after China's parliament passed a sweeping national security law for Hong Kong this past summer, Wong disbanded his pro-democracy group, Democisto. Under the new law, any activity Beijing considers subversion, secession, terrorism, or collusion may receive up to life in prison.
That was Brian Wood of Reuters. As the Islamic State fell in Iraq, tens of thousands of men were arrested and accused of supporting the extremist organization. But years later, hundreds of those who were subsequently set free still languish in desert camps. VOA's Heather Murdoch has this report with Halana Khoi from the Hassan Sham camp in Iraq.
This camp, like so many others in Iraq, was built in 2016. As Iraqi and coalition forces attacked Islamic State-held territories and returned control of them to Iraq's government. At least 1 million people fled at the time, many to the semi-autonomous Kurdistan region in Iraq. As they fled, young men often were arrested for their potential role in IS. Many were found to be guilty. Many were not. Mahmoud, 25, was detained for 2 years after being arrested and accused of being involved with IS. They found him not guilty and let him go, but he cannot go home. Like about 200 others in this camp alone, Mahmoud was released from a Kurdish prison only to find his release papers are not recognized outside of the region, in mostly Arab Iraq, where his family lives. If he tries to go home, he can be arrested all over again. And while the Iraqi government makes plans to close displacement camps across the country, currently housing about 2 million people, families like his are settling in. Recently, Mahmoud got married in the camp and moved his mother from their village to the camp. At the Hassan Sham camp office, Mivan Aki, the camp manager, says without a solution, these families are stuck. He says conditions are harsh in the camp, with searing hot temperatures in the summer and cold, wet winters. But many families, with even loose past associations with IS, stay here for a modicum of physical security. And young men living in camps say the longer the situation goes on, the harder it will be to solve. They say stigma surrounding those who remain in the camps is growing. Mohammed, 21, was arrested as a juvenile in the Kurdistan region and accused of being involved with IS. One day, as a teen, officers told him their investigation was over and he was released. They said he should go to school and make a good life. But he soon found out this was impossible. His brother was also released and tried to go home, only to be arrested again and sentenced to 15 years for a crime for which he was already acquitted. He says now, after years in the camp, it is even more dangerous for him to leave. Many people say the only families left in camps are associated with IS. But in the camp, there is no school, no work, and no way to build a future. Camps that are currently closing have left tens of thousands of people stranded already, according to aid groups. And former detainees here, whose release records are not recognized in other parts of Iraq, say their homes may be lost to them forever. Heather Murdoch, VOA News in Istanbul, with Halan Akoy in the Hassan Sham camp in Iraq.
That's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Beijing's onslaught against Hong Kong's freedoms and liberties continues. The United States strongly condemns the patriotism resolution passed by the National People's Congress Standing Committee on November 11th, which disqualified four members of Hong Kong's Legislative Council. The resolution allows Hong Kong's executive to expel lawmakers deemed to be advocating the city's independence, colluding with foreign forces, or threatening national security without having to go through the courts, according to press reports. This move fundamentally undermines the right of the people of Hong Kong to choose their elected representatives as guaranteed by the Basic Law, and further exposes Beijing's blatant disregard for its international commitments under the Sino-British Joint Declaration. U.S. National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien said the Chinese Communist Party, or CCP, has flagrantly violated its international commitments, and the United States will continue to identify and sanction those responsible for extinguishing Hong Kong's freedom. In June, the CCP passed a draconian national security law in Hong Kong, which punishes anything Beijing considers subversion, secessionism, terrorism, or collusion with foreign forces, with up to life in prison. Since then, Beijing has eliminated nearly all of Hong Kong's democratic processes and many of the legal traditions that have been the bedrock of Hong Kong's autonomy, stability, and prosperity. Once again, said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in a statement, the CCP's twisted vision of patriotism is a pretext to stifle freedom and the call for democracy. The United States will continue to work with its allies and partners around the world to champion the rights and freedoms of the people of Hong Kong and call out Beijing's abject failure to honor its commitments. We will hold accountable the people responsible for these actions and policies that erode Hong Kong's autonomy and freedoms, declared Secretary Pompeo. We stand with the disqualified pan-democratic lawmakers, the pro-democracy lawmakers who resigned in protest, and the people of Hong Kong.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 22:30 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.